Japan has been largely closed off to foreign travelers since 2020. Today, though, that changes. Live from London, this is the Marketplace Morning Report from the BBC World Service. I'm Victoria Craig. Good morning. Throughout the pandemic, Japan has had some of the world's strictest COVID-19 mitigation measures. Even last year, overseas visitors were banned from attending the delayed 2020 Tokyo Olympics. But starting today, it's reopening borders to tourists from nearly 100 countries and regions, though some new restrictions will be put in place. The biggest, travelers must be part of a packaged tour. They must buy medical insurance and wear masks in all public places, including outside. The BBC's Mariko Oyden has just been to the capital, Tokyo. She explains why the country is pursuing such a limited reopening.
I think it's a huge dilemma that the Japanese government basically has, because the tourism industry has been hit quite hard, and therefore they want to bring back some tourists. But at the same time, you know, there's still enough opposition from the Japanese public. A lot of people in Japan still wear face masks, even though it's not, you know, required by law. And they're worried that if foreign tourists come in, maybe they wouldn't oblige to those kind of social norm as you would in Japan. And as a result, this could actually trigger more COVID cases. But at the same time, you know, the businesses have been really suffering and pressuring the government to at least ease some of the restrictions. So this is kind of we're opening up, but very cautiously, so that we're not just relaxing it fully. There are a lot of rules that those tourists must follow. But it looks like there's been a lot of interest, and I think they're testing it out so that they can relax it further in the future.
And the overall economic picture globally is such a focus for people in countries all over the world. In Japan specifically, inflation is rising, but it's a very different situation to what we're seeing in other major global economies, isn't it?
Absolutely. Inflation is everywhere, but this is a country where we just never experienced anything getting more expensive. So I grew up in Japan and I never remember anything becoming more expensive. If anything, you know, I remember my parents repeatedly telling me how the value of our home where I grew up in collapsed in the 90s when the property bubble burst. So I was taught to, you know, save, 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 don't ever spend money. You know, this is basically the gist of a deflationary cycle, that people don't spend actively when prices keep falling or at least stay stable. And as a result, people have been really shocked to see this inflation this time. But unfortunately for the country's central bank as well as for the government, this inflation wasn't triggered by any of the good reasons like domestic demand, strong economic outlook. It was only triggered because of the war in Ukraine and also COVID restrictions, global supply chain, everything that everyone else is experiencing as well.
The BBC's Mariko Oy for us. Thanks so much for breaking this down.
Thanks, Victoria.
Well, as Mariko mentioned there, the Japanese yen hit a 20-year low against the U.S. dollar yesterday. Now, both the government and central bank today, in a rare joint statement, said they're concerned about the sharp declines, which could signal they're ready to intervene to bring more stability to the market. Checking some other numbers now, global stock markets are solidly lower this morning as investors continue to fret about rising inflation rates and global central banks preparing for rate rises. Benchmarks across Europe are down in the 1 to 1.5% range at this hour. Meanwhile, there are expectations that Russia's central bank in the next half hour or so will cut interest rates by 1 percentage point to 10%. Capital Economics economist Liam Peach explains why.
The Russian central bank is shifting very quickly from tackling financial stability and inflation risks to trying to support the economy and boost lending growth. In March, Russia was facing a rapidly depreciating currency that was pushing up inflation. There were concerns about the health of the banking system and deposit flows among households and non-financial corporations. Those risks have all now faded, and the central bank has slashed interest rates by 900 basis points. And it's focusing a little bit more on trying to support the recovery now that the crisis seems to have stabilized.
900 basis points is 9 percentage points. I mean, for people who are listening and talking about, you know, what we've seen from the ECB this week, telegraphing a rate rise of 0.25 percentage point. I mean, that's huge, isn't it? These moves are not insignificant.
Yeah, it's a massive reduction in interest rates. The central bank raised them all the way up to 20% in the few days after the war, and they've been brought right back down now to 11%. I think what we could see today is another big reduction of 1 to 2 percentage points, perhaps to 9 to 10%. That would actually take interest rates to below the level they were at before the war started. So it's been a big shift in the stance of the central bank to now trying to get the economy growing again quickly by lowering interest rates. And I think the central bank now is becoming a little bit more concerned that the ruble, although it's had a very strong run in recent months, it's appreciated very sharply, it may now actually be too strong. And although those inflation risks have stabilized, the ruble at the level that it's at now is not necessarily good for Russia's growth prospects over the course of the year.
And sort of talking about the broader economy, I mean, it isn't easy times for Russians living in the country. Inflation there is still just above 17% at this point. I mean, what is the economic situation like there for people?
Yeah, the economic situation is still very challenging. Yeah, inflation's very high. Household incomes have been hit very hard. There's been reports of a lot of job losses. I think the labour market's going to be hit quite hard in the coming months. The government is trying to increase fiscal support. It's giving money, cash handouts to families, increased unemployment benefits. But it's going to be a huge hit to the economy this year, with a large drop in production across almost all sectors of Russia's economy, particularly those that are most dependent on imports, because that's where sanctions have had the most impact.
Liam Peach from Capital Economics, thanks so much for breaking this down for us.
No problem at all.
The biggest ever global study kicked off here in the UK earlier this week focused on the merits of a four-day work week. More than 3,000 people from about 70 companies are participating in the experiment, and they'll work fewer hours with no loss of pay. Many of you had questions or thoughts about that move, so I put them to two people focused on the issue, Professor Abigail Marks from the Newcastle School of Business and David Stone. He's in charge of recruitment at the consultancy MRL. David's company implemented a four-day week system 3 years ago. He started by telling me why the six-month trial period proved it was a worthwhile move for the company.
Productivity had increased by about 30%. Absenteeism, sickness, had reduced by nearly 50% during that period. And it's very difficult to measure mental health, but something like 87% of employees felt that their mental health had either improved or in a better place after a six-month trial period.
Professor Marks, I just want to come to you. We've been hearing from David there that employees are feeling happier. They have a little bit more personal time that they can spend how they like. But from an economic standpoint, is a four-day work week a good idea?
It's a good idea if it is not detrimental to productivity and people's well-being. David's example is fantastic. I think it obviously is a big success story. My worry about organizations implementing it at the moment is people are overworked. So based on recent research that we have undertaken, between 40 and 50% of employees are now saying that they are struggling with mental health because of workload. I can only see that getting worse. I would like to see a shortened working day. I've not seen anything like it in terms of work intensity.
And perhaps that has to do with industry to industry then. Are there variations that you're finding with the feeling of overwork?
Generally speaking, most office-based workers are really struggling, particularly since people in the pandemic started home working. It was an opportunity that organisations could really get the maximum out of people. People were working evenings, weekends. Is it a difference in organisations? A little bit, but a lot of it is to do with office-based workers, white-collar workers that are particularly subject to this at the moment.
David, what are your thoughts on that? How did you and your company sort of deal with that and make sure that employees didn't feel like they were more stressed?
Some people slipped into the new rhythm of work very, very efficiently, very quickly. Funnily enough, it was some of the younger people, the people in their early 20s, who took longer to adapt their rhythm and workflow. Because ultimately what we were saying to staff was, we're not going to lengthen the hours. It's a four-day week as long as we're hitting our objectives. And then we worked with people as a management team from a desk-by-desk basis to work out where individuals needed assistance to improve their efficiencies, because there is no cookie cutter on this. Everyone has got different pressures on their desks.
And importantly too, David, you made it that this isn't a mandatory policy too, which might help lessen the pressure. Professor Marks, I just want to come back to you, because we went to our listeners and asked them if they had any questions about how companies are, you know, sort of implementing these policies and the economic impact of those. And a couple of the concerns talked about how they worried that these kinds of policies deepen class divide between hourly and salaried employees. One person pointed out wages haven't risen as quickly as productivity has in the last several decades, so would this worsen that problem too? What is your take on that?
The first point is absolutely right, that there are a group of employees, although this is not universal because we've obviously seen really good examples in hospitality of the four-day week. But often it is the privilege, it's office workers, white-collar workers, that will have the privilege of the four-day week, and also that the organisations can make it manageable. I think going back to David's point about productivity, which in part relates to the second question, is there's certainly a lot of research that says people can't work efficiently between more than 4 or 5 hours a day. But the breaks that people are taking have really, really reduced. So implementing it in organisations now will be much more problematic, because people are working more intensively in that 8-hour period.
And I guess this also goes back to the industry question, doesn't it? Because different jobs require different working hours. You know, some days you may be able to get away with just a few hours a day, and others require longer working days.
Absolutely. And some jobs are finite as well. So there are jobs you can't do anything beyond your office hours. You don't take it home with you. There aren't the odd email that you can send. You can't follow up on things. And I think that makes it much more realistic to implement a four-day week. I think with those jobs that aren't in that position, it's very easy for people to spill over. And certainly the pandemic encouraged that sort of behaviour in employees, which, as we noted, wasn't healthy. I think there just needs to be an overall look at working hours and talk about the four-day working week, or reduce hours in a five-day week, or however we do it, things have to change.
So perhaps not black and white, but more flexibility. This is a fascinating discussion. Professor Abigail Marks and David Stone, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
In London, I'm Victoria Craig with the Marketplace Morning Report from the BBC World Service.
With access to so much information, it's hard to feel like an informed, discerning citizen. That's why on Make Me Smart, which is a podcast from Marketplace, we make it easy for you to stay in the know. Hi, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Every weekday, Kimberly Adams and I unpack the latest from Washington, D.C.
The Senate minority leader has announced that he will step down as the Republican leader.
What's happening in AI? I mean, don't buy at the top, but holy cow, artificial intelligence and all the companies related to it are the hot new thing. And we do the numbers.
So as a refresher, inflation is the rate of increase in the prices of things. It's not just sort of things getting more expensive. It's the speed at which things get more expensive.
Because in a world that's constantly changing, we all need to stay smart. Listen to Make Me Smart wherever you get your podcasts.